Hello and welcome to the Palliative Care Journal Watch podcast by Pallium Canada for May 2024, where our panel of palliative care experts keeps you informed of the latest peer-reviewed palliative care literature. Our hosts, Dr. Jose Pereira and Dr. Sharon Watanabe, join us for the 13th episode of the Palliative Care Journal Watch. If you'd like to access accompanying slides and links to the articles discussed in today's podcast, visit the link in the episode notes. This podcast is a collaboration between Pallium Canada and the divisions of palliative care at Queen's University, McMaster University, McGill University, University of Toronto, University of Manitoba, University of Calgary, University of Alberta, and the Hadassah Hebrew University Medical Center in Israel. It is a part of the Palliative Care ECHO Project, which aims to support continuous professional development among healthcare providers across Canada who care for patients with life-limiting illness. The Palliative Care ECHO Project is supported by financial contributions from Health Canada. However, the views expressed in today's episode do not necessarily represent the views of Health Canada. With no further ado, it's time for the Journal Watch.
Hello and welcome to this, the 13th episode of the Pallium Palliative Care Journal Watch, brought to you by Pallium ECHO Project. This is a partnership between Pallium Canada and several divisions of palliative care across Canada and also internationally. And they include the McMaster University, University of Calgary, University of Alberta, Queen's University, University of Toronto, McGill University, University of Manitoba, and the Hadassah Hebrew University Medical Center in Israel. And today with us is my co-host, Sharon Watanabe, and we have a guest panelist, Dr. Aingiran Sinaraja. But before I introduce you to them, just very quickly, the process is that we have teams working in these various divisions of palliative care across Canada and in Israel, and we monitor over 30 journals, and the people monitoring these journals will then identify what they think are papers, articles that challenge our way of thinking on a topic, that confirm things that we're doing, and help us keep up to date with the literature. And so those are submitted to the editorial board that's made up of an editorial board of four persons. We go through those and then we select what we think are the top 8 to 10. We present the top four and we also provide you with the honorable mentions of the others. So that's the format we use. The Palliative Care ECHO Project is a five-year national initiative that aims to cultivate communities of practice across the country, involving many different professions and folks from right across the country, from different care settings, from community hospitals, long-term care, etc. It's supported by a financial contribution from Health Canada. And it's important to note the views expressed herein do not necessarily represent the views of Health Canada. I'm Jose Pereira, and I'm professor in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Navarra in Spain and the Institute for Culture and Society. I'm also a professor in the Division of Palliative Care in the Department of Family Medicine at McMaster University in Hamilton, and I'm the co-founder of Pallium Canada and a scientific advisor. And I'm going to hand over now to Sharon, the co-host, and Sharon will introduce herself.
Hello, everyone. I'm Sharon Watanabe, palliative care physician based at the Cross Cancer Institute in Edmonton, and I'm also director of the Division of Palliative Care Medicine at the University of Alberta.
And our guest panelist, who appears quite often, and does a fantastic job monitoring different journals. And in fact, in today's Journal Watch, two of the articles that we've identified were actually selected by Aingiran. So Aingiran.
Nice to be back. Aingiran Sinaraja. I work out of Lake Ridge Health clinically, and I also have an academic appointment with Queen's University.
Today's Journal Watch has got a little bit of a few things, of different things, as is often the case. So today we're actually going to be looking at two papers that have to deal with telecare or telemedicine. We've got an article that looks at palliative care outside the cancer population, so specifically COPD, heart failure, interstitial lung disease, and Aingiran will be presenting that. We'll be looking at a letter that we think is a really good starting point to have a good discussion amongst the panelists in terms of trials around developing sustainable models for palliative care delivery. And then we're going to be looking at telemedicine in support of advanced care planning and the impact on it related to unplanned hospitalizations. And that's amongst high-risk patients with cancer. And we'll explain what high-risk means shortly. And then the final one is looking at antipsychotics. There'd been a series of studies around that, and this is one that we thought would be useful to base a discussion around. So with that then, I think we are ready to go. And so Ingeron, over to you.
So as already mentioned, this article is looking at what palliative care might look like for patients with non-cancer illnesses. And particularly this study looked at COPD, interstitial lung disease, and heart failure. And we all know that they are severe diseases, severe morbidities, including breathlessness, fatigue, pain, sleep disturbance. And so this team has published on a intervention called Advancing Symptom Alleviation with Palliative Treatment, ADAPT. All interventions in research now needs an acronym, a very good acronym, ADAPT intervention. And so they looked at the effect of a nurse and social worker palliative telecare team on quality of life in outpatients. So this is also looking at outpatients, which is interesting, with COPD, heart failure, interstitial lung disease compared with usual care. So it's a single blind randomized clinical trial. They looked at these patients who had a high risk of hospitalization in the next year. They picked the 20th percentile of risk using this tool called the Care Assessment Needs Score. And they also looked at those who had poor quality of life and or bothersome symptoms. And they looked at least one of pain, fatigue, depression, shortness of breath, or trouble sleeping. Exclusion criteria included anybody with cancer, metastatic cancer, substance misuse in the prison system, pregnancy, lack of a family doctor, primary care clinician. So this would be important in the intervention you'll see soon. Living in a nursing home, prior heart and lung transplant, or no consistent phone access, because this was a telecare intervention. They did look at the veteran affairs sites, a couple of them. And this ran over almost 4 years from 2016 to 20, so just before the pandemic. So as I mentioned, it included a nurse and a social worker. They were not palliative care specialists, by the way, disease agnostic clinicians. They each made 6 phone calls. So that was 2 per month for 6 months. That was the aim. They each received 8 hours of training. So the nurse received training on the symptom management, communication, motivational interviewing, and the social worker on psychosocial interventions. And then additionally, and I have not seen this in other trials as routinely, they had weekly collaborative team meetings with the family doctor, so the primary care clinician, the palliative care specialist, and the disease specialist, so the cardiologist or respirologist. So they had weekly team rounds where the physicians and everybody would decide on next course of actions, if needed, tests and meds would be ordered and help with the next week's phone call. So usual care was an educational handout of self-care given to the patients, and then, you know, care at the discretion of the clinicians, that compared to the intervention. The primary outcome was actually a cancer tool, quality of life tool, which they just used this one as well. And they also looked at some disease-specific health statuses and depression and anxiety. So what did it find? Not surprisingly, again, recall that this is a veteran affairs site. So 90% were males, they're veterans. 80% were white, almost 70 years old was the mean age. Most had COPD, some had heart failure, and a very small amount had interstitial lung disease. And if you look at their illness trajectory over the prior year before this trial, half had been hospitalized. The mean length of the intervention once it was started was about 4 months. And on average, most patients got 3.5 calls, phone calls. And the most bothersome symptom was shortness of breath. And it looked like in the primary outcome was significant, with a significant improvement in quality of life of 6 points in the intervention group versus 1.4 points in the usual care group. And this, by the way, met the minimal clinical difference threshold of 4 points. There was also clinically meaningful improvements in anxiety and depression and disease-specific quality of life. So that's those secondary outcomes we mentioned. Interestingly, again, I believe this is because of the veteran affairs model. A lot of these patients were already connected to mental health specialists and counseling. So really, to me, in terms of the discussion and what the authors are mentioned as well, is that this is one of the few early palliative care trials in non-cancer that has shown benefit now, because we know that the other studies were mixed. And this study also differed in that it did have that collaborative care that was integrated into ongoing outpatient care. It was a single intervention, And they also made a comment that the effect size on the outcomes was actually quite good compared to a lot of the other palliative care interventions. So some of the strengths are, again, they attempted to reach out to all the eligible patients. It was virtual, so perhaps a bit easier to do. It was integrated with primary care. So that reminds us why there was an exclusion for those without primary care. And most participants, you know, met the intervention fidelity. So it was a high intervention fidelity and reasonably high follow-up rates. But some of the limitations are that there was only one nurse who did the phone calls at both sites. So you wonder about whether this could be generalizable to other clinicians. Might be just the one nurse who was really, really good. We also know Veteran Affairs conducts a lot of innovative models of care. And so how realistic is this to spread to other organizations? And interestingly, when they called a lot of people, but only 12% of participants ended up getting randomized because 50% were unable to be reached, 25% were not interested, 12% didn't have time. So it ended up with a lot of effort to get 12% of patients meeting criteria. And we also know the high proportion of men we mentioned. And it turned out, interestingly, the mortality was actually low. They had that high mortality risk tool they used, but those who were actually randomized were actually quite well. And there was only about 4%, 3 to 4% mortality on follow. So the other point I'll make perhaps is that this is a generalist palliative care trial, not a trial. We know that there are very few studies that are positive when we look at generalist palliative care. And so what might this mean for non-cancer? Is it the weekly collaborative meetings with primary care that was perhaps very good? So lots of things to think about.
Very good. Thank you. So Sharon, any thoughts?
Yes, this reminded me of a trial by Marie Bakitis in the U.S., randomized controlled trial looking at patients with heart failure. And the intervention was a palliative care nurse making, I think, 8 calls that were more coaching type of intervention. And it was negative in terms of finding any differences in quality of life between the two groups. It makes me wonder if the difference is that collaborative care model where there's actually a discussion with physicians, including the primary care physician and the palliative care specialist, the disease-focused specialist. And so I wonder if that's a key part of what led to the success of this trial.
Shen, do you remember at all if in the Bagetis trial, the measures were the same as this one? The outcome measures used were very appropriate, but I think we sometimes miss others that may be important. I mean, even the sense of being supported, you know, mm-hmm. the sense that there is someone watching over me.
Right. It was a cardiomyopathy specific quality of life measure that was used in that trial. And I think that'll be one of the issues raised in the editorial about outcomes. And you know what outcome should we be looking at? Mm-hmm. The other thing that this paper brought to mind, this is a primary palliative care intervention in the end. And especially here in our program, we're struggling to hire enough people who are specializing in palliative care. And I don't know that we'll ever have enough to meet the needs. So it's interesting to see that this type of model can make a difference and you know expand the reach of palliative care.
For me, that was one of the key findings or areas of interest with this study, because exactly as you say, there's no ways I feel that palliative care teams would be able to meet all the needs of a population. And what I found really interesting about this model is that there were nurses and social workers who, if I understood correctly, didn't have a lot of training, but they had some additional training, and that was really able to make a difference. And it makes me wonder about in COPD clinics, in heart clinics, in primary care clinics, you know, what if instead of integrating or embedding a palliative care physician or nurse in those teams, because there aren't so many of us around, what about developing local folks as a resource in that team? We often hear primary care is overwhelmed. There's a workforce challenge facing Canada and many other countries as well. And perhaps in primary care, there is an opportunity of using local resources as they did here.
And you're right. I mean, it was 8 hours of training, I believe. So it's not undue, but that is something to be said, I think, to what Sharon said, right? It's the collaborative, the specialist was still there contributing and giving advice once a week. And I think there's something about the primary care being involved that I think is powerful that this study particularly looked at. And I don't think I've actually seen any other palliative care trials that specifically brought in the family doc. And again, this is Veteran Affairs. So I have a feeling they're already innovative enough. They're probably all embedded together into a clinic. as a standard of care, I have a feeling. But that speaks to, I think, also the benefits, isn't it? But even despite that, there's this extra benefit that they have seen with 8 hours of palliative care trained clinicians. Yeah.
The other interesting thing I found was there's a low mortality rate. But for me, that says that there is an initiation of the palliative care approach much earlier in the illness trajectory, which is, I think, is a big goal. A lot of studies to show that the earlier you initiate palliative care, not just for cancer patients, but for non-cancer patients as well, the better the outcomes for the patients, families, and the healthcare system as well. So I thought that it was actually quite refreshing to see a low mortality rate indicating early in the illness. I don't know, Sharon, what you thought about that?
Yes, so that's an important observation.
Very good. Thank you, Angaran. And I think the next one's yours.
So this one is interesting, and we purposely padded with the first one because this is the accompanying editorial on the same journal, same issue, that accompanied that first article. And that's because that's actually a second article that I'll briefly talk about with this editorial. So there were three articles in that issue that all touched on palliative care, including this editorial. So the second article, just briefly, just because the editorial mentions it, is that the second article is that it looked at inpatients and it looked at default orders for palliative care consultation. So automatic orders for patients with, again, non-cancer. So that looked at dementia, COPD, and kidney disease. And they looked at the default orders. And so there was an automatic palliative care consult order placed for these patients. And these were patients who were at, again, high risk of mortality and adverse events during the hospitalization. And the introduction of the editorial, they talked about, again, how we need more research for palliative care in non-cancer populations. Again, the first study we just saw showed improvements, but interestingly, the second study had a different outcome. They looked at hospital length of stay, and there was no change in that primary outcome. So it was a negative study from that outcome, especially. So the comments that the editorial made were that maybe the second study was negative because one of the things that the second study did not do is they did not add extra resources. So there was all these default new orders going in, but the palliative care team numbers did not increase to meet it. It was still the same number of staff. And so we have already heard that there is just not enough of us to see everything. And so interestingly, again, at the end of the study, they documented that half of the consults actually ended up not being seen by the palliative care teams because there was not enough staff. A good thing was that the attending teams did not cancel most of the default order. So most of them thought this is fine, this is appropriate. So only 10% were canceled. The editorial commented on how it is not enough to just change workflows and just do new things around extra default things, but really implementation, paying attention to acceptability, sustainability are key. And so part of that is adequate resources and staffings. And so they have specifically called out that palliative care is not free. They also commented on that it seems to be no perfect primary outcome in palliative care trials. We have seen now two outcomes, and depending on the outcomes, perhaps that's what determines whether something is positive or negative. And so how do we figure out what is the right outcome? To me, these three articles, including the one we didn't spend too much time on in the inpatient side, is that, you know, we need more research in non-cancer for palliative care models. It might actually be different from cancer palliative care. And I also mentioned this because just a week ago or 2 weeks ago, ASCO updated their guidelines. And they now say advanced cancer patients need specialist palliative care because there were most of the primary palliative care trials were negative in cancer. And so this one trial that I mentioned, that I talked about before, the primary palliative care did work. And so maybe there is something there. Also now, perhaps the focus should be on implementation projects in real world settings. And how does outcomes look like in those implementation projects? And pragmatic trials are probably needed. And perhaps we have to accept that there's no perfect primary outcomes. And we have to be careful with a pragmatic trial that we don't throw in multiple outcomes because the patient burden will be higher then. And then the editorial author also commented that the hospital length of stay was an interesting outcome. It is often not an explicit goal for palliative care teams, which is true. We don't go in wanting to decrease that. And then also hospital palliative care teams and outpatient teams, you know, what are the differences? Hospital teams, certainly, I think everybody, even in Canada, will agree it's increasing. I think a lot of hospitals now do have palliative consult teams. But outpatient, perhaps, is still variable, especially in the non-cancer world, I would say. It's still probably low, I would argue. So how do we look at the whole CDSL population? Is it a collaborative model that we need to think about where, just like Veteran Affairs, you fund the whole team, disease specialist, primary care, palliative care, instead right now in Canada, you know, a lot of funding is primary care separate, hospital separate, outpatient clinics are separate, isn't it? So maybe that needs to also change. So again, I'll stop there and invite the panel for comments.
Very good. We did forget to mention the names of this for the purposes of the podcast. So this particular article is by Cotwell AA. I hope I pronounce it correctly. And it's entitled A Tale of Two Palliative Care Trials, Developing Sustainable and Transferable Models. And it was published in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, in January of 2024. And the previous one, the positive one, was by Beckelman, DB, and colleagues. And that was entitled Nurse and Social Worker Palliative Telecare Team and Quality of Life in Patients with COPD Heart Failure or Interstitial Lung Disease, the ADAPT Randomized Clinical Trial. And that was published in the same issue, as we've said. So with this one, there was a statement about primary palliative care, there'd be negative trials. And I disagree with that finding, because I think that we might be looking at the wrong outcomes, but it is impossible, as we see in this trial, for specialist palliative care teams to provide all the palliative care. And I think we need to ask the question, okay, what does primary palliative care look like? And by the way, just recently I had a discussion with someone around what do you call the palliative care approach provided by primary care teams? Well, that's primary palliative care, but they feel that that term should be used only to describe the palliative care approach provided by primary care teams, and that we should use the term generalist palliative care to refer to the palliative care approach provided by other specialty areas, so oncology, internal medicine, etc. I'm not so sure if that caps it. I just say palliative care approach done by different specialties. But one of the barriers, I think, is, and I've seen it over and over again, is lack of training on the palliative care approach. So it's difficult for them to do palliative care if they don't know what to do or how to do it. And I think that sometimes it's happening. And in a large study that we published looking at the impact of the learning essential approaches to palliative care course, LEAP Core, and we looked at commitments to change at the end of the training and then 4 months later, there were many examples of good primary level palliative care being implemented in practice. So I think we've got to be very cautious about concluding that there is no impact with primary palliative care. It's complex. And we need to address where those areas are, for example, that we need to focus on. That's training and also other resources. Curious to hear what you thought about that, and Sharon as well.
Yes, I feel like that really we're compelled to strengthen the primary generalist palliative care model because of our resource constraints. I haven't seen the updated ASCO guidelines yet. I just saw a summary of it, but I think they've moved away from, you know, a time-based approach to specialist involvement and more needs-based, which I think makes more sense. So definitely allows for that palliative approach to care to be implemented by everyone else involved in that patient's care.
I still grapple with what is the right course. And I don't think specialist palliative care teams in being involved early means they're involved every day, every week, every month. It could simply be a one-time consultation with recommendations with this collaborative model where they stay on the side with the primary teams, knowing they have somebody to back up and call for help. Because I think some of the things I've heard from family doctors is like, I'm happy to do it, but what if this happens? What if that happens? Are you available for me to call to ask for help? And I think that is what sometimes the backup of us can bring, perhaps. And as you already mentioned, the family docs and others, like they already have a lot on their plate. And so that's what I struggle with, knowing they already have all these things on the plate. This is perhaps a core competency, I agree, but it does take time. And so in some ways, what do they have to stop doing to do this, right? Like, it's not a question of them sleeping less to do more. They have to stop doing something else that they're already doing. And that's what I struggle with. And if specialist palliative care can help intermittently, and maybe we advocate for more resources, maybe it's both, but I don't know where that balance lies. Yeah.
I wonder whether it's having to replace what you're doing really with something else. It's not, I don't think it's always a matter of if I do this, then I've got to drop something else. I think sometimes it's a matter of doing something differently. So if the palliative care approach includes having earlier advanced care planning discussions, earlier goals of care discussions, it does not necessarily take a lot more time. It may take a bit more time in the first visit, but you save a lot of time later. And I think we forget to sometimes look at this on the long term. When we've trained a lot of family physicians and cardiologists with LEAP Heart and nephrologists with LEAP Renal, a lot of them say, you know, this is just very good care. It's just doing good care in our daily practice. there will be patients, I think, that require a lot more assistance and help. And I think that's where we need to look at some innovative models. And that's why I really like the first paper, because it looks at a resource person within the clinic. Perhaps a starting point would be the interprofessional clinics and exist in some of the provinces across the country. You know, is identify another profession who doesn't always have to be the family physician in a cardiology clinic, in a nephrology clinic, doesn't always have to be the physician. But maybe it's about doing things differently rather than having to drop something in order to do this. And when there is more help needed, which sometimes happens, is the supports, a model where there's support. That's my thought. It worries me, these automatic referrals, you know, that as soon as this happens, you automatically activate a call to the palliative care team, because I have seen examples of where the team gets overwhelmed very quickly. And the message that it conveys, whether explicitly or implicitly, is only we can provide the palliative care. And then with time, I think it can sometimes become a self-fulfilling prophecy where then the message is that only the palliative care team does it. Just an observation. And I think we just got to be cautious. I think the approach of education, supporting, probably yields more than an automatic referral. And I know there'd be other thoughts around that. Great. Thank you. Excellent paper. So the next article by Bunga, EM, and colleagues, entitled The Association Between Telemedicine, Advanced Care Planning, and Unplanned Hospitalizations Among High-Risk Patients with Cancer. And that was published in Cancer in the February issue of this year, 2024. And this was identified by Idea Shalof, our colleague who's in Israel. He cannot be with us, so I'll present it. And the article in the introduction speaks about how telemedicine is widely used in various clinical settings, primary care, in various specialty areas, but it hasn't been studied much for advanced care planning. And the authors write, for patients with incurable or high-risk cancer. And in this article, high-risk was defined as someone who has a life expectancy likely in the order of 6 months or less. But they wrote that patients with incurable high-risk cancer, high-quality care requires detailed conversations about treatment priorities, advanced care planning. Now, I think we've got to interpret this that it's a US-based study, and the concept of advanced care planning may mean different things in different jurisdictions. You know, I think in Canada, it's largely around reflecting on our wishes for future care and end-of-life care, and identifying a substitute decision maker. In this setting, it might have meant something different. And then clinical care to minimize unnecessary acute care or specifically unplanned hospitalization. So the study goal was to assess whether telemedicine affects advanced care planning and unplanned hospitalizations versus in-person clinic visits among patients with cancer at a high risk for 6 month mortality. So the methods, they used a retrospective cohort study. Patients presented to a US university system, and they looked at patients who came in from April to the end of December 2020. As I said before, patients at a high risk of dying within 6 months, and they used a machine learning algorithm that is embedded into the electronic health record to identify these patients. The data was extracted from the electronic health records, and the endpoints were as follows. So the primary endpoint was advanced care planning, and they defined it for the purpose of the study as presence or evidence of code status discussion and or detailed serious illness conversations. And then the other primary endpoint was unplanned hospitalization, so documentation of a hospitalization that was not planned. The secondary endpoints looked at the quality of advanced care planning that occurred. And for this one, they looked at the components as described by the Serious Illness Conversation Guide to indicate what would be a high quality intervention. They also collected patient demographic information. The follow-up until primary endpoint occurrence, so they followed up these patients until the ACP occurred or the hospitalization occurred or death, or 3 months after the initial visit. They also compared different types of telemedicine. So they compared the video telemedicine versus by telephone. So the results, they had identified just over 3,000 patients. Of these, 77% of them were seen in person, 23% were seen by telemedicine, and this is at the first encounter. And for those who were seen by telemedicine, just over two-thirds of them were seen by video, and about a third of them were seen by phone call. About 37% of the patients were seen by oncologists. Just over 7% were seen by what they refer to as mixed clinicians. And that wasn't very well defined in the paper, but I presume it's generalists, probably internal medicine, primary care, I presume as well. And 56% of the patients were seen in subspecialty clinics. So let's look at the primary endpoints. Advanced care planning. Overall, of those patients, seen. And remember, these are patients that were identified as having a high risk of mortality within the next 6 months. Only 6% had received advanced care planning during the three-month follow-up period after that initial visit. There was no meaningful difference between the groups, so no meaningful difference between the telemedicine group and the in-person group. For the telemedicine group or subgroup, there was more documented ACP in video-based visits than in telephone-based visits. Of the ones that did, where there was an indication of advanced care planning, about 83% of them were considered high quality, and that was similar, interestingly, between the in-person and the telemedicine group. When they looked at the telemedicine subgroup, they found that in the phone group, less likely to have high quality ACP conversations than the video based. In other words, the video based seemed to be better than the phone based. When they looked at the other main outcome, and that is for unplanned hospital admissions, overall 19% of these patients, of the over 3,000 patients, had unplanned admissions during the three-month follow-up period. There was no meaningful difference, and this is interesting, between the two groups, between the in-person and the telemedicine, and there's no difference between the video and the phone-based telemedicine when they looked at the telemedicine subgroups. In the discussion, and I've quoted them verbatim, the authors wrote, "In this study, care delivered by telemedicine compared to in-person clinic visits produced comparable rates of advanced care planning conversations without increasing hospitalizations, which suggests that vulnerable patients can be managed safely by telemedicine." And then they wrote, "Overall, our findings suggest that vulnerable patients can be managed safely by telemedicine without negatively affecting key components of their care, such as advanced care planning and acute care utilization." The strengths, I thought, of the study, it's a large cohort and they define quite well the outcome measures. The limitations, this is a single center. Exposure was defined as a first encounter type. It's a retrospective study and there may be other confounding factors that may limit the application of these results. Overall, I thought the ACP rates were exceptionally low. I was thinking you would see a lot more. So for me, that seemed to be a place for improvement. What I found interesting was that it can happen, as we saw during the pandemic, using telemedicine. But for me, I was feeling it'd be good to do even more studies and perhaps mixed method studies to explore with patients what it felt like. What was the experience like if you were to do it in person versus do it by some telemedicine form? It did mention the lack of physical examination may be concerning in some cases, because sometimes some findings may be missed if you do this by telemedicine. In other words, beware of over-reliance on telemedicine the whole time. And again, I think we saw that during the pandemic. So I think I'll stop there. And any thoughts on this?
Some comments I would make is that this is a retrospective cohort study. And so I hesitate to draw a lot of conclusions based on that, because they also commented on how the functional status they eventually had to exclude from adjusting, because most patients, they could not find the ECOG status for these patients. And so you wonder whether those who were in telemedicine were just a bit more functionally poorer. But you're right, the ACP rates were still quite low, but it's actually not surprising to me. It tends to be very low. And in this particular case, I was reading that they looked at specific sections of the electronic chart to see whether they documented in there and not in the rest of the progress notes, which I think a lot of clinicians tend to do. And so that I wondered about as well. And then the last comment I would make is that I wasn't clear and I couldn't find anywhere whether this high risk of mortality was actually presented to the clinicians, or whether it was just something they retrospectively looked at and the algorithm said, because the reference was a retrospective study again, where they developed this algorithm. So I'm not sure this algorithm actually produced an alert telling the clinicians, by the way, this patient is also at high risk of mortality, do something different. So I have a feeling it didn't, because otherwise they probably would have explicitly mentioned it. So
higher rates.
Yeah, so I worry, I wonder whether that's also why it was low.
Yeah, you're right, it wasn't described. But if you were to do a prospective study, it would seem to make sense, not just from a research perspective, but also in terms of quality improvement implementation, that if you are going to use these machine thinking reminders, and there's studies actually are showing that, you know, identify these patients, it is a prompt and it's an alert to do something about it and increase, as you say, these ACP rates and discussions. Sharon, any thoughts?
Yes, like Angaran, I was wondering about the documentation. because we use Epic here as well. And you know, most of the documentation goes into the progress note as opposed to the ACP section. The other thing I had noticed, and they had looked at compared video versus telephone, but they were different populations, it seems. The ones who got the video follow-up were high proportion of white patients and high income. So difficult to draw conclusions around the modality per se.
Yeah, very good. The next one is one that I found in Supportive Care in Cancer. It's by Kurisu and colleagues. It's from Japan. It's entitled Effectiveness of Antipsychotics for Managing Agitated Delirium in Patients with Advanced Cancer, a secondary analysis of a multi-center prospective observational study in Japan, a study which is called Phase R. This is the one where it was disconnected to a previous study. So in the introduction, they speak about delirium being a common complication in patients with advanced cancer and that we need to treat it effectively. They spoke about small doses and short-term administration of antipsychotics is often recommended for reducing delirium symptoms, especially when the delirium is got moderate to severe hallucinations, agitation, etc. However, the author said that the use of antipsychotics remains controversial. And it's interesting because a decade or two ago, we wouldn't be saying that. We would just say we need to be using low doses of an antipsychotic, such as haloperidol or one of the new atypical antipsychotics, particularly if it is moderate to severe. And then there have been some studies published. And this article refers to some of those papers published over the last, I would say, about 6 years. One of them, that large center study out of Australia, or led out of Australia. In this particular study, then, so the study goals was to explore an effective pharmacological intervention for agitated delirium in patients with advanced cancer in real world settings. And they had done a previous study, and that is what is called the Japan Pharmacological Audit Study of Safety and Effectiveness in Real World, or they called it the Phase R. And in that particular study, they used the Delirium Rating Scale Revised 98, so the DRS R98, as their primary outcome. Now, the DRS looks across different aspects of delirium, so cognitive functioning, etc., agitation, hallucinations, attention, etc. And in that particular study, they found that quetiapine was the one that was associated with more improvement. And they looked in the study, they included quetiapine, olanzapine, haloperidol, chlorpromazine, among others. And in that particular study, they used machine learning model that was trained with the same data set that helped them with a selection of drugs or looking at the different drugs for the treatment of delirium. And they found no influence on predicting improvement. So they thought in this particular one, they're going to use the RASPEL, so the Richmond Agitation Sedation Scale, which looks at the level of agitation and the level of sedation. So at +4, it's someone who's very agitated, very combative. At -5, profoundly sedated, perhaps one can argue excessively sedated. And so they thought maybe they would look at a different tool, particularly if one is concentrating clinically on controlling agitation without overly sedating the patient. They identified agitation as a 1 or more on the RASPEL, so 1 to 4. The study outcome was that there would be a RASPEL of 0 or less, showing no agitation, but more than a -2. And the argument was that if there's deeper sedation, then a -2, so a -3, -4, -5 would indicate excessive sedation. They used the regression models, and they looked at haloperidol, chlorpromazine, olanzapine, quetiapine, and risperidone. They also did an additional analysis where they broke up the antipsychotics into groupings. There was one called the multi-acting receptor-targeted antipsychotics, which they called MARTA, and examples of that, olanzapine and quetiapine. Then they had the serotonin dopamine antagonists, which they refer to as SDAs, and the example of that was risperidone. They also had perospirone. But they excluded that in the analysis because there were too few patients that were on that to allow them to do analyses. And then the typical antipsychotics, chlorpromazine and haloperidol. Now, the results. So in the study, so in this retrospective analysis of data that they'd really collected, they found 271 patients that met the diagnosis of an agitated delirium. In other words, a RASPEL of more than 1. As I said before, perospirone and trazodone were excluded because of small numbers. The mean dosages per day that were used, and this is on day 3, so their primary outcome was on day 3 following initiation of treatment. Haloperidol, the mean dosage per day was 7.4 milligrams. for olanzapine was 6.3 milligrams, for quetiapine was 60 milligrams, risperidone was 1.3 milligrams. 32% of the patients on day three fell within the RASPAL of zero or less, and -2 or -1. In other words, this is what the goal was. So 32% of the patients were treated adequately or appropriately, or effectively rather, by this regimen. They looked at, in this particular one, remember the previous one, quetiapine was the one that stood out as being the most effective. In this one, they found that olanzapine was the one associated with a statistically significant improvement in the delirium. So in this case, agitation. They also did a subgroup analysis looking at patients taking oral medications. And for that one, again, olanzapine had the more significant odds ratio. And for the MARTA and the SDAs, not significant and very small effect sizes. So in the discussion, they write, olanzapine may effectively improve delirium agitation in patients with advanced cancer as per the RASPAL scores by day three. The previous study, as we said before, had found quetiapine was the one that stood out most favorably amongst the others. Previous studies had showed no superiority of one drug over another, and the management strategy for delirium may depend on the indicator used. So they found different results when they looked at it using the delirium rating scale versus using the Richmond Agitation Sedation Scale. They feel there is a role for olanzapine for delirium palliative care settings, and that has been previously investigated as well. There may be increased sedation with the medication, but the exact role remains unclear. Limitations, so very wide confidence intervals in the odds ratios that were observed, and they feel that perhaps it is because of the relatively small sample sizes per drug. There were unmeasured confounders related to the facilities. So for example, one facility over another may have a preference of using one or other management of the delirium. And they feel that we, in this particular study, did not consider the trade-off between efficacy and safety. So open for discussion. I think this is the ongoing debate. What is the role of antipsychotics? When do you bring them in? And then when you do initiate them, which one?
Do you know whether it looks like it was from the previous study? And what does the illness trajectory look like for this cohort? Like, were they close to death? Is some of these terminal deliriums?
Yes, actually, they did look at that. And I should have mentioned that. Let me find it in the original one. Estimated prognosis was, it was a mixture. So estimated life expectancy as estimated by the attending clinicians was order of days in 15%, was weeks for just over half of all the patients, and was thought to be months in about 29% of patients.
They didn't look at actual survival, I guess.
That was just an estimated as per the clinical signs noticed during the clinical assessment.
Well, as you mentioned, the preference for sedation sometimes is preferred based on patient context and family context and clinicians. And so you wonder again whether some of the other antipsychotics actually were better at sedation because that's actually what the patient and family wanted, right? And so,
or what is needed by the patient, right?
Mm-hmm. I concur with the comments that have been made already. I wondered, they made reference to the fact that they were limited in injectable antipsychotics. They didn't, I think it implied that haloperidol was one. It didn't really specify if they had the others, but it made me wonder if the patients who got haloperidol may have been sicker and couldn't take things orally.
And there's no mention, I think, of any other one, as you say, right, that is given either parenterally or through the buccal route. I presume that's that would be available, right, the buccal route for olanzapine.
Okay, there's one question. Has a newer med, brexpiprazole, been used at all for agitated delirium?
I don't know that medication. So would be happy to. Do you know of it, Angaran?
It looks like it was approved by Health Canada in 2019 as adjunctive treatment for depression. I have not used it. I have not seen it being used.
Yeah, I have no experience with it.
Well, that's something we could look up into and see what the role of that is. And then to finish off, we're at the top of the hour, the honorable mentions. There is a study by Applebaum and colleagues, a randomized controlled trial of a distress screening consultation and targeted referral system for family caregivers in oncological care that was published in Psycho-Oncology in February of this year. There is a paper by Tate and colleagues entitled Evaluation of a Novel Hospice-Specific Patient Decision Aid, and that was published in the American Journal of Hospital and Palliative Care in April of this year. There is a paper by Hughes and colleagues looking at advanced heart failure, parenteral diuretics for breathlessness and peripheral edema, a systematic review. I found that one particularly interesting, and that was published in the BMJ Supportive Palliative Care. and that was February of this year. And then there was a article by Braun and colleagues entitled Cannabis and Cannabinoid in Adults with Cancer and the ASCO Guidelines. And that was published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology in March of this year. So let me take this opportunity then to thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed it. I really want to thank Dr. Sharon Watanabe and Dr. Aingaran Sinaraja for joining us today. Thanks for the Palliative Care team for the support given. And thank you to all the folks that are listed here in the different divisions of Palliative Care for their monitoring of the over 30 journals that we monitor. Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. I'm James O'Hearn, and I hope you found it both enjoyable and informative. If you'd like to learn more about the Journal Watch program or our other palliative care ECHO project activities, feel free to email us at echo@pallium.ca. That's echo@pallium.ca. Or visit our website at www.echopalliative.com. The music for this episode is Dazed by Airtone. Copyright 2012, licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 license. You can find Airtone's music at dig.ccmixter.org. Today's episode was produced by Diana Vince. See you soon!